Disc 7.
The door opened, and there was this guy, shirt rumpled, tie askew, face pale, standing in the door holding a yellow legal pad, waiting for orders, like a slave. A friend of Jenkins, who would visit him in Washington and board with him for a few nights, recalls him returning to his home so tired that he fell asleep in the bathtub. Johnson was working him like a nigger slave, he says. And always Johnson was reminding the staff that the indispensable quality he required in them was loyalty, and he defined what he meant by that. I want real loyalty. I want someone who will kiss my ass in Macy's window and stand up and say, "Boy, wasn't that sweet." Because his treatment of his staff had become known on Capitol Hill, Johnson had been stymied for years in the House in attempts to recruit talented individuals to work for him. With a single exception, his administrative aide, John Connolly. The remarkable abilities of this future governor of Texas, which impressed everyone who came into contact with him, John Kennedy would make Connolly his Secretary of the Navy, Richard Nixon his Secretary of the Treasury, and Nixon called him the man best qualified to succeed him as president, had camouflaged the lack of other top-flight talent on Johnson's congressional staff. The congressman himself felt Connolly possessed an abundance of the indispensable attribute. "I can call John Connolly at midnight, and if I told him to come over and shine my shoes, he'd come running," Johnson would say. "That's loyalty." But now Connolly had evidently decided that 10 years of doing it in Macy's window was enough. Not long after the election that sent Johnson to the Senate, Connolly flatly refused to return to Washington with him and accepted a job with the Austin law firm of Alvin J. Wirtz, the former state senator and canny political string puller who was the single most powerful figure in Johnson's congressional district and a key figure in Johnson's career. Johnson had several replacements in mind, men of outstanding qualifications and Washington expertise, but having observed how he treated his staff, they declined to join it. Trying to tempt Bryce Harlow, who would later serve as a high-level assistant to Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon, and who was already a highly respected congressional aide, Johnson offered him not only a salary but stock in his radio station. And Johnson's proposition was reinforced by Connolly, who was friendly with Harlow and came to his office to plead with him to take his job, saying, "For God's sake, I can't go on like this." But there was a problem of ethics. Pragmatic though Harlow might be about politics, he knew he would have a problem with Lyndon Johnson's brand of pragmatism. "I went and spoke to Vinson about it. This was a man whom Lyndon was close to. The old man sat there and looked at me very penetratingly. Then he wheeled around and looked out the window. Dead silence. Wheeled back around. 'Bryce, it won't work. You wouldn't last 6 months. Lyndon cuts his corners too close.' And I knew he was right. I knew somewhere along the line he would take some action I could not go along with, and I'd have to say, 'I can't do that, Senator.'" And there was a personal problem. Lyndon would maneuver people into positions of dependency and vulnerability so he could do what he wanted with them. I'd watched what he did with Walter Jenkins. He broke Jenkins. To work for Lyndon Johnson, you had to be willing to accept the black snake, whip, and not even scream. Harlow determined that no matter what Johnson offered him, he would never work for him. Then Johnson offered the job to Jim Rowe, a successful lawyer and one of Washington's most respected political insiders. But Rowe says, "It was all right to deal with Johnson as long as you had a little independence. But if you were on his payroll, well, I had seen how he treated people who were on his payroll." And the effect of Connolly's absence was going to be exacerbated by the fact that Johnson was in the Senate now, as became apparent to Johnson with the first assignment he gave one of Connolly's assistants, Warren Woodward. Woody was one of the young men deeply dependent psychologically on Lyndon Johnson. Handsome and courageous, during World War II he had flown 35 missions over Europe. He was keenly aware of his limitations. Asked years later about his role in Johnson's organization, he would say, "Well, I wasn't in on strategy. I carried his socks and underwear. That's what I could do for him, and I was proud to do it." And knowing he was going to have to take over some of Connolly's duties, he was nervous. There was a feeling in the office when we moved to the Senate that we had to step up our game to a new level, that the Senate was the big leagues, he would say. And with his first assignment, he and his boss found out that the nervousness was justified. The assignment, in early December, before Johnson had even been sworn in as a senator, was to obtain enough extra tickets to President Truman's inaugural ball so that Johnson could accommodate all his financial backers who wanted to attend. "I was just as green as a gourd," Woody would recall. The official he saw first at inaugural headquarters was unable to satisfy his request and sent him to see a woman whose name Woody caught as Miss Masters. "I went in and poured out my story to the lady," Woody said, and when she agreed to help, decided to do her a great favor in return. With the air of someone giving a thrill to a functionary who would be honored to dance with a senator, he said, "I know Johnson will be very grateful, and I wouldn't be surprised if he wants to have a dance with you." When he related the story to Johnson, Johnson was puzzled as to the identity of Miss Masters, until the light dawned. "Her name wouldn't be Mesta, would it?" he said. "You were talking to Pearl Mesta." His assistant had told Washington's most famous hostess that he would, as a favor, have his boss give her a dance. "Well, that was how green we all were, without John there with his sophistication," Woody says. Not long after this, and after Harlow and Rowe and several others had refused to fill Connolly's place, Johnson began telephoning Connolly at Wirtz's law firm, cajoling and pleading with him to return. "You got to come, John. You got to hire my staff. You got to help me. I'm going to be new. I need help, John." And when the pleading and cajoling failed, the big hand tightened on the telephone and the voice became low and threatening. "Now you listen to me. By God, you either come back and reorganize my staff or find me someone who can." And then he slammed the receiver down so hard that the base shook. And a moment later, he picked up the receiver again to telephone Connolly's new boss. And a few minutes later, Connolly would recall, "Senator Wirtz called me in. He said, 'John, I know you don't want to go to Washington. I don't blame you. But, you know, I just don't really think we have any choice.'" Connolly told Johnson, however, that choice or not, he would stay for only a single Senate session, and his unhappiness in the job was so evident that at the end of the session Johnson allowed him to leave for fear he would infect the rest of the staff. Chapter 6. The Right Size. His first steps along the Senate path showed how rocky it might be for him. All Lyndon Johnson's life he had been grabbing, for more than his share of boarding house food, for more than his share of radio advertising, for House committee seats to which he was not entitled. And now he tried to grab for the first two things he wanted in the Senate, committee seats and office space. He made his moves fast. The three most desirable committees were Appropriations, Finance, and Foreign Relations. And luckily, or so Johnson thought, the senior senator from his own state, Tom Connolly, was not only a power on two of them, chairman of Foreign Relations and ranking member of Finance, but was also, thanks to the Senate's long Christmas recess, ready to hand. And hardly had Connolly arrived back in his hometown of Marlin in early November when Johnson flew up to see him, accompanied by John Connolly, no relation to the senator. They were met at Waco, the nearest airport, by Frank C. Posh Oltorf, then a second-term member of the Texas legislature, who drove them to Marlin and went up with them to Connolly's suite in the Falls Hotel, where the two younger men sat on a sofa as the old senator and the new one chatted. After a while, Oltorf recalls, Lyndon said he'd like to discuss committee assignments, and he'd like to be on Foreign Relations, and of course he'd like to be on Finance. Senator Connolly, Oltorf recalls, took out of his breast pocket a little book with the list of Senate committees, and pulled his glasses down on his nose to leaf through it. He took a long, leisurely puff on his big cigar. Then, looking at Johnson over his glasses, he said, "Well, now, Lyndon, let's see. Oh, now here's the Agriculture Committee. You could get on that, and you could help the farmers. You're for the farmers, ain't you, Lyndon?" Johnson said he was. "I thought I heard you say something about it during the campaign," Senator Connolly said. Connolly's eyes were just twinkling, Oltorf recalls, and he paused to savor the moment. "And you can get on the Armed Services Committee," Connolly said, "and then you could help A&M, the Agricultural and Mechanical College of Texas, which depended on federal grants for military research and officers' training corps programs. You're for A&M, ain't you, Lyndon?" Oltorf does not recall whether or not Johnson made any reply to this question. By this time he was sitting there with his arms crossed. He never cracked a smile. Johnson didn't like to get worked over. Connolly looked at him again over his glasses. "And then, Lyndon, after you've been in the Senate for a while, then you can get on the Foreign Relations Committee or the Finance Committee and render a real public service." Speed was of no more assistance on Office Space. Within days of his election, Johnson was telephoning Carl Hayden, whose Rules Committee assigned offices. Of course, he said, he understood that offices were generally allocated according to seniority, but he hoped that an exception could be made in his case, since under seniority he would be entitled only to a three-room office, not one of the more desirable four-room suites, and his circumstances were exceptional, since Texas was the largest state in area and sixth largest in population, and he would need a large staff to serve his constituency. Hayden gave him a noncommittal reply on the phone, and then sent a letter saying simply that as a result of retirement or defeat, six four-room suites were to be vacated, and they would be tendered to the six senior senators now occupying three-room suites. These rebuffs only made Johnson intensify his efforts, using the lever which could move so much in Washington. Aware that both Hayden and former Majority Leader Alvin Barkley, who was leaving the Senate to become Vice President but was still immensely popular on Capitol Hill, were old friends of Rayburn, he asked the Speaker to intercede with them, and Rayburn did. And Johnson had his own coterie of friends within the Truman administration, most notably his fellow Texan, Attorney General Tom Clark, who assured him that he could persuade the President to put in a good word with Barkley, and he asked these friends to make some calls, and they did. He wrote more letters. Giving up on foreign relations and finance, since without Connolly's support, appointment to either one would be highly unlikely, he switched his attention, writing to Appropriations Chairman Kenneth McKellar that, "I want very much to have you as my chairman," and to Barkley and the influential Walter George that, "Since Texas joined the Union in 1845, only one Texas senator has served on appropriations, and this was more than 25 years ago, and that this inequity was all the more glaring because Texas was currently receiving more federal appropriations than all but three other states." And in mid-December, Johnson went up to Washington to make his mark on the Senate in person. His first encounter was with a young Capitol policeman who was stationed outside the Senate office building entrance to ensure that no one but senators parked near that door. He was one of the young men who had been told about senators, "Whatever they want you to do, you do it." There were no assigned parking spaces, but as could be expected, the more junior senators left the three or four spaces nearest the entrance for their seniors. Pulling around the corner from Massachusetts Avenue, Johnson drove his Cadillac onto Delaware and pulled into the parking space nearest the door. Since Johnson had not yet been given a District of Columbia license plate with a senatorially low number, the young policeman did not know he was a senator and came up to the car to protest. Johnson simply ignored him and went inside. The young man, having ascertained his identity, didn't say anything when he returned. Arriving earlier than any other senator for the next few mornings, Johnson parked in the same space. But one day he found another car already in it. Although there were other empty spots along the curb immediately behind it, Johnson's fury led the policeman to secure a reserved stanchion and put it in that spot the next day to ensure that it would be available for Johnson. Nonetheless, not long thereafter, there was again another car in that spot when Johnson pulled up. Telephoning the Capitol Police Chief, Olin Kavnis, Johnson told him to get that goddamned car out of there. Calling Johnson back a few minutes later, Kavnis said that he had checked with the policeman and the car belonged to a senior senator. Kavnis evidently felt that that explanation would end the matter, but it didn't. "Well," Johnson said, "while I'm getting some more seniority, you put a cop there every morning to guard my space until I get there." Kavnis told the policeman to put not one but two reserved signs in that space. That device worked because no one cared to inquire about the signs, and they would remain until Johnson's car would turn onto Delaware, and the officer who had been watching for him would hastily roll them up out of the space so Johnson could park there. But that was his only victory on the mid-December trip. He may have been able to win in a conflict with a young policeman. He had less luck with senators. For 2 or 3 days he did what he had done during his days in the House, striding around the Senate office building corridors to various offices, bounding in the door with a big smile, saying, "Hi, I'm Lyndon Johnson from Texas. How's everyone from Pennsylvania today?" Saying it so winningly that he would draw smiles even from the traditionally dour Senate receptionists, asking, "Is the senator in? Is he alone?" And if the answers were affirmative, walking over to the door to the private office, knocking on it, opening it, and asking if he could come in and chat for a few minutes. He got the chats. The invariably courteous Hayden, for example, never refused to see anyone, and of course he would never be too busy to see a friend of Mr. Sam's. But the chats, and pro forma promises to do everything I can to help, were all he got. The levers Johnson had tried to use were levers outside the Senate, and the Senate reacted to their use as the Senate always reacted to outside pressures. Barclay brushed him off with a letter so cold that Rayburn, to whom Johnson showed it, tried to console him by saying that, of course, it must have been written and signed by one of his secretaries. Walter George was courtesy itself at first, as he let Johnson know that it was inappropriate for a new senator to try to bypass the seniority system. But when Johnson persisted in his arguments, he all but showed him out of his office. He tried writing Barclay again. This time the former majority leader did in fact let his secretary reply to "your letter with further reference to your desire to be assigned to appropriations," in a missive even colder than the first. After all the letters he had written and the phone calls he had made to try to force his way onto foreign relations or finance or appropriations, he was no closer to a place on these committees than if he had written no letters or made no phone calls at all. As for office space, Hayden told Johnson that while he had more seniority than four of the House members who had come over with him, and of course more than the eight newly elected senators who had no House service, he had less seniority than the 83 other senators, and he wouldn't be assigned an office suite until all 83 had chosen theirs. It appeared to him, Hayden said, that the most desirable three-room suite available for Senator Johnson might be number 231, which would be appropriate, since it was the suite that had been occupied by his two predecessors from Texas, Senators Morris Shepherd and Pappy O'Daniel. Perturbed not only by 231's size, but by its location, next to a snack bar and, in the northwest corner of the building, inconveniently distant from the subway to the Capitol, and possibly misled by the softness of Hayden's tone, Johnson may have pressed him too hard to alter this line of reasoning. Hayden finally ended the discussion with a remark which, for Hayden, was unusually sharp. "The trouble with you, Senator, is that you don't have the seniority of a jackrabbit." And not long thereafter, another letter from Hayden arrived. "I am pleased to inform you that the three-room suite 231, Senate Office Building, now occupied by Senator O'Daniel, has been assigned to you for your office." And when Johnson said he assumed that in that case he would also be assigned the extra little room in the basement, 102B, that O'Daniel had had the use of, Hayden replied that, unfortunately, Senator Forrest Donnell of Missouri had requested that extra room. Senator Donnell had more seniority than Senator Johnson. That room would be assigned to Senator Donnell. Lyndon Johnson's trip got him nothing that he had gone to Washington to obtain. Unproductive though that trip to Washington may have been, however, Lyndon Johnson did not return from it unhappy, for the Senate Office Building had not been the only place he had visited on that trip. He had also gone over to the Capitol and had looked, for the first time as a senator, at the Senate chamber. Walter Jenkins, who was with him at the time — they had entered the chamber by the side door near the Senate reception room, he would recall years later — would never forget that moment. With the Senate not in session, only a single row of lights was turned on in the ceiling high above, and the chamber was shadowy and dim, but those lights reflected off the polished tops of the 96 senators' desks as the long arcs stretched away in the gloom. Lyndon Johnson stood just inside the doorway, silently staring out over the chamber, for what Jenkins would remember as quite a long time. And then he muttered something, speaking in such a low voice that Jenkins felt he was speaking to himself. And if Jenkins would not recall Lyndon Johnson's exact words, he did recall the gist of what he said, that the Senate was the right size. Jenkins felt he understood what Johnson meant by that, as did Horace Busby, to whom Jenkins repeated the words not long thereafter. While Lyndon Johnson was not, as his two assistants knew, a reader of books, he was, they knew, a reader of men. A great reader of men. He had a genius for studying a man and learning his strengths and weaknesses and hopes and fears, his deepest strengths and weaknesses, what it was that the man wanted, not what he said he wanted, but what he really wanted, and what it was that the man feared, really feared. He tried to teach his young assistants to read men. "Watch their hands, watch their eyes," he told them. "Read eyes. No matter what a man is saying to you, it's not as important as what you can read in his eyes." And to read between the lines. More interested in men's weaknesses than in their strengths, because it was weakness that could be exploited, he tried to teach his assistants how to learn a man's weakness. "The most important thing a man has to tell you is what he's not telling you," he said. "The most important thing he has to say is what he's trying not to say." For that reason, he told them, it was important to keep the man talking. The longer he talked, the more likely he was to let slip a hint of that vulnerability he was so anxious to conceal. "That's why he wouldn't let a conversation end," Busby explains. "If he saw the other fellow was trying not to say something, he wouldn't let it, the conversation, end until he got it out of him." And Lyndon Johnson himself read with a genius that couldn't be taught, with a gift that was so instinctive that a close observer of his reading habits, Robert G. "Bobby" Baker, calls it a sense. He seemed to sense each man's individual price and the commodity he preferred as coin. He read with a novelist's sensitivity, with an insight that was unerring, with an ability, shocking in the depth of its penetration and perception, to look into a man's heart and know his innermost worries and desires. Such reading is a pursuit best carried out in private, Lyndon Johnson alone with a man, getting to know him one-on-one. And Johnson's gift was not only for reading men, but also for using what he read, for using what a man wanted, to get from him what he wanted, to sell the man on his point of view or on himself. And this, too, as Jenkins and Busby knew, as indeed everyone who spent much time with Lyndon Johnson knew, was a talent that operated best in private. "Lyndon was the greatest salesman one-on-one who ever lived," George R. Brown said of him. And in that sentence, "one-on-one" was the operative phrase. The essence of his persuasiveness was his ability, once he had found out a man's hopes and fears, his political philosophy and his personal prejudices, to persuade the man that he shared that philosophy and those prejudices, no matter what they happened to be. In words that are echoed by Busby and Jenkins, and by many others who had an opportunity to observe Lyndon Johnson at length, Brown was to say that Johnson had the knack of always appealing to someone about someone that person didn't like. If he was talking to Joe and Joe didn't like Jim, he'd say he didn't like Jim too. That was his leadership. That was his knack. But such a technique worked, of course, only if Jim wasn't around, and only if there was also no one around who might one day happen to mention to Jim what Johnson had said about him. It worked best if no one was around, if the conversation was strictly one-on-one. Moreover, since Johnson used the technique not only about personalities, but also about philosophies, liberals thought he was a liberal, conservatives thought he was a conservative, it worked best if there was no one present from the other side. He operated best in small groups. The smaller, the better, Jenkins said. For 11 years, however, Lyndon Johnson had been trapped in a body so large that he couldn't work in small groups, much less one-on-one. Everything in the House of Representatives was done en masse, from the swearing-in by the Speaker at the opening of each Congress, where all 435 members, crowded together on the long benches in the House chamber, stood up together, raised their hands, and repeated the words of the oath in unison, as if they were a group of draftees being inducted into the army, to committee meetings. Each House committee was a substantial body in itself. On the House Armed Services Committee, Johnson had been one of 36 members, so many that at meetings they had to sit on a long dais in two tiers. With its hundreds of members, its crowded, noisy corridors and cloakrooms, with its strict formal rules and leadership structure made necessary by its size, the House was an environment in which, as one observer put it, members could be dealt with only in bodies and droves. The Senate was very different. With fewer than 100 members, it was less than a quarter of the size of the House, a much more personal, more intimate body, one in which, as a commentator puts it, most interactions were face-to-face. The great reader of men would have to read only a relatively small number of texts. Furthermore, because of the longer senatorial terms, those texts would not be constantly changing as they were in the House. They could be perused at length, pored over, studied and restudied. What text could, under such favorable circumstances, remain impenetrable to Lyndon Johnson's eyes? He would have ample opportunity not only to read his men, but to make use of what he read, in ideal conditions. In subdivisions of the Senate, the contrast with the House became even more dramatic. Most Senate committees had only 13 members, so that a committee meeting was a small group of men sitting relaxed around a table. Each Senate committee had subcommittees to handle specific areas of the committee's business, and most Senate subcommittees had only 5, or perhaps 7, members. Not a few had only 3. A member of a 3-man subcommittee needed to sell only one other senator to carry his point. And Lyndon Johnson was the greatest salesman one-on-one who ever lived. And, Jenkins would say, Jensen appears to have felt all this, to have felt the implications of the Senate's smallness for his particular talents, in that moment in the doorway of the Senate chamber, in that moment when he stood staring out at those 96 individual desks. From the first day on, Jenkins says, and Jenkins explains that he means from that day when Johnson stood in the doorway, from the first day on, he knew he could be effective there, make his influence felt. It was the right size, just the right size. It was his place. He was at his best with small groups, and he was one of only 96 senators. With only 95 others, he knew he could manage that. The difference, and the implications, must have been dramatized to Johnson even more vividly by the swearing-in ritual for the 32 newly elected or re-elected senators at the opening ceremonies of the 81st Congress. He was in the 5th group of 4 senators to be sworn in, and it was a distinguished group. Behind Johnson as he walked down the aisle, escorted by old Tom Connolly, chairman of the mighty Foreign Relations Committee, was the young Tennessean, Estes Kefauver, his arm held by the old Tennessean McKellar, chairman of Appropriations, then Robert S. Kerr of Oklahoma, escorted by old Elmer Thomas of Oklahoma, chairman of Agriculture, and South Carolinian Olin Johnston, escorted by the Charleston aristocrat Burnett Rhett Maybank, chairman of Banking and Currency. They walked down the aisle slowly, McKellar hobbling on his cane, Thomas, his eyesight almost gone, shuffling, feeling for each of the 4 steps with his feet. But with dignity, and the face of Vandenberg above them as they approached was the face of the Lion of the Senate, familiar from a score of magazine covers. All 4 of the just-elected senators were over 6 feet tall. They stood very straight as, their right hands raised, they took the oath with the older men beside them. And after they had answered, "I do," a clerk pushed the Senate register, a well-bound book kept for that purpose, toward them, and Lyndon Johnson signed at 9 minutes past noon and went not to a crowded bench, but to a desk, his own desk. Later, he took the little subway beneath the Senate to the office he hadn't wanted. And though Suite SOB 231 may have had only 3 rooms instead of 4, they were senatorial rooms, high-ceilinged, spacious. On one wall of his private office, adjacent to his private bathroom, was a delicate marble fireplace, the hearth flanked by 2 slender marble columns. Above the fireplace was a tall gilt-framed mirror, and behind his desk was a high, wide-arched window, recessed and framed in mahogany. It looked out over the green parks of the Capitol Plaza, and beyond the plaza was the Long Mall and the great pillar of the Washington Monument. Margaret Mayer of the Austin American Statesman, who had known him for many years in Texas and who had covered the 1948 campaign, went to interview him there. Referring to the hard campaign, and perhaps, since Ms. Mayer was a perceptive reporter, to his hard life, she asked him if it had all been worth it to be seated at last in that office. Lyndon Johnson winked at her and nodded and grinned. His path in the Senate was also made smoother by other gifts that he possessed. talents that he had been demonstrating all his life and that he now demonstrated again, vividly, during his first year in the Senate. One was an ability to transform his outward personality, his demeanor, and mannerisms, not to change his nature, but to conceal it, an ability that had always been one of Lyndon Johnson's most striking characteristics, as had a strength of will that enabled him to make a transformation remarkably thorough. The most recent of these changes had occurred during the very election that had won him this Senate seat. The campaign's first months, when he had been confident of success, had been filled with the familiar explosions at his subordinates, vicious tirades, laced with obscenities and with insults designed to find his target's most vulnerable point, that made both women and men weep. He had refused to control himself, had seemingly found it impossible, so sudden and violent were the rages, to control himself. Even in public, even in places where the tirades would be witnessed by the voters he was trying to court. Arriving at one Rotary Club meeting where he had expected to give only brief remarks, he was told that a longer talk would be desirable. Wheeling on his hapless advance man, he screamed as the club members gaped, "I thought it was just going to be coffee, donuts, and bullshit!" Armored against critical newspaper articles by his friendships, crucially important in Texas journalism, with publishers, he refused to control himself even in front of reporters, not only shocking them with his treatment of secretaries, unable to bear watching him shout unbelievable obscenities at the sweet-faced, soft-voiced Mary Rather, who was standing head-bowed and crying in front of him. Felix McKnight of the Dallas News suddenly found himself jumping in front of her, yelling, "You can't talk to her like that! Apologize to her!" But giving them a taste of the treatment themselves. "Come on!" he shouted to stubby Dave Chevens of the Associated Press, who was sensitive about his weight. "Won't those fat little legs of yours carry you any faster than that?" His treatment of people not connected with the campaign who were similarly unable to defend themselves, waiters and bellhops, desk clerks and cooks, was the same. Storming into a hotel kitchen, a towering figure holding a large steak in one hand and waving it in a cook's face, he raged, "Whoever told you you were a cook? Didn't you ever hear of cutting the fat off? I've never seen so much fat on a steak in my life." And he seemed to feel he didn't have to control himself. Lyndon just seemed to think he was entitled to talk to people that way, one reporter says. But in the latter stages of the campaign, when he had suddenly realized, with only a month to go, that he was almost hopelessly behind and could not afford to antagonize voters, the tantrums ended instantly and completely. Busby, who had been assigned to accompany him on the next trip, was dreading the experience. "I had learned one thing. When he got angry, hide." Now he watched in astonishment as Johnson greeted the first desk clerk he encountered with a gracious smile and gracious words, saying, "You have a very fine hotel here. I stayed in it before, and I'm looking forward to this visit." He told the bellhop who carried his baggage to his room, "I'd like to shake hands with you if your hands weren't so busy." After the bellhop had put down the bags and had had the handshake, Busby started to give him a tip. "Son, he's a cheap tipper. I don't want him tipping you," Johnson told the bellhop, giving him a $5 bill. And the next morning, Busby awoke to find Lyndon Johnson sitting beside his bed. He wasn't there to give Buzz orders. He was holding something in his hands. "Here, Buzz," he said, "I went down and got a coffee and donut for you." And he didn't simply hand the two items to Busby. He would hand the sleepy-eyed young man the coffee, wait until he had taken a sip, and take the coffee back, and only then would hand him the donut. After Buzz had taken a bite, Johnson would take the donut back and then hand him the coffee again, sitting beside the bed, holding one of the two items himself so that his assistant wouldn't have to hold two things at once. During that entire month, that all-or-nothing month, no matter how high the tension rose, Lyndon Johnson was, in Busby's phrase, a changed man. He never lost control of himself, not once. Now, after the campaign, safely in the Senate, he changed back, but only in some areas of his life. He was the old Lyndon Johnson driving to work in the morning from his home, a two-story, white-painted brick colonial at 4921 30th Place in a quiet residential area in northwest Washington. Driving down Connecticut Avenue with one hand on the wheel, the other frenziedly twisting the dial on the car's radio back and forth from one station to another searching for news broadcasts, shouting obscenities at broadcasters who said something with which he didn't agree. He was constantly sounding his horn to get other drivers out of his way. If they didn't move aside quickly enough, he would lean out the window and curse them. Passing them on their right, he would bang his big left hand down on the outside of his car door to startle them. His arrival on Capitol Hill was still as ostentatiously attention-getting as possible. His long affair with Alice Glass, the tall, spectacularly beautiful small-town girl from Marlin who had become the elegant hostess of a manor house in the Virginia Hunt Country, had faded out during the war. That affair, the most serious of Lyndon Johnson's life, had been kept very secret, in part because Alice was the mistress, she would later be the wife, of a man very important to Johnson, Charles Marsh, publisher of the Austin American Statesman, in part perhaps because of Johnson's feelings for her, which men and women privy to the affair believed were so intense that they felt Johnson might divorce Lady Bird and marry her. During his last years in the House, after that relationship ended, Johnson began arriving on Capitol Hill in the morning in the company of another tall, beautiful woman, one who was famous as well. And now that he was in the Senate, he sometimes still got out of his car with her, and they walked to his office openly holding hands. When Helen Gehagen Douglas was named one of the 12 most beautiful women in America, the critic Haywood Bruin begged to disagree. "Helen Gehagen Douglas is 10 of the 12 most beautiful women in America," he wrote. At the age of 22, the tall, blonde Barnard College student with a long athletic stride became an overnight sensation in the Broadway hit Dreams for Sale, and she was to star in a succession of hit shows, marrying one of her leading men, Melvin Douglas. Deciding to study voice, she made her debut in the title role of Tosca in Prague, and toured Europe in operas and concerts for 2 years before returning to more Broadway starring roles and radio appearances. On screen, she played the cruel, sensual Empress of Kor in the film version of H. Rider Haggard's novel, She. By 1936, the New York Herald Tribune noted that Helen Gehagen Douglas has made her name in 4 branches of the arts: theater, opera, motion pictures, and radio. Driving across country with Douglas after their marriage, Helen had been touched by the plight of Okies trekking west, and plunged into a new field, politics, with her usual success. She became Democratic National Committee woman from California, and in 1944, at the age of 43, ran for Congress from a Los Angeles district, and won, becoming one of 9 women members of the House of Representatives. Washington, one journalist wrote, had prepared for her tall, stately, and gracious beauty, but they weren't prepared for her brilliance, in short, her brains. A friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's, whose husband, Helen said, was the greatest man in the world. She was a frequent guest at the White House, while Melvin remained back in Hollywood making movies. On the House floor, she was a striking figure, generally surrounded, as one account noted, by attentive male colleagues, and she was a riveting, charismatic speaker in her advocacy of liberal causes, particularly civil rights. Declaring that she stood by the Negro people when they needed a sentinel on the wall, Mary McLeod Bethune called her the voice of American democracy. She won re-election in 1946 and again in 1948, and was one of the most sought-after speakers for liberal rallies across the country. And in an era in which age supposedly dimmed a woman's charms, hers seemed as bright as ever. A profile in the New York Post in 1949 commented that during her years in Congress, her waistline has grown even slimmer, her face leaner. In her speech at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia the previous year, the Post said, she boosted her stock still higher by turning out to be gorgeous on television. The New York Daily News called her the number one glamour girl of the Democratic Party. It was widely expected that she would run for the Senate from California in 1950 and would win. She had first met Lyndon Johnson in 1945 when, shortly after she arrived in Congress, he dropped around to her office, draped his long frame in one of my easy chairs, and asked how things were going. When she said that she was having trouble organizing her office, he said, "Well, come up and see how my office is run." She found his office very impressive. It worked. If he wanted something, it came within a half second. There were other industrious offices, she was to recall, but the efficiency of this office and the extent that they went to reach the lives of his constituents in an intimate way was something that utterly fascinated me. She was impressed as well by qualities which she discerned, with a very penetrating eye, in his character. By his instinct for power, he never got very far away from Rayburn. By his ambition, he was in a hurry, in a great, great hurry, and he was willing to make the compromises necessary, I believe, to stay in Congress. And by the method by which he concealed views that might stand in the way of the realization of that ambition, a method that she felt required great strength. Lyndon Johnson talked so much, she saw, but he never said anything that could be quoted back against him later. Was it just caution, she was to say, just that he didn't want to have a lot of his words come back at him? He was witty, he would tell stories, he was humorous, but he was always aware that what he said might be repeated or remembered, even years later. And he didn't want someone to come back years later and say, "I remember when you said." She began to realize, she says, that Lyndon Johnson was very strong. In Washington, she was to say, everyone tried to find out where you stood, but he had great inner control. He could talk so much, and no one ever knew exactly where he stood. This tall, lanky, charming man was actually one of the most close-mouthed men I ever knew. When, years later, John Kennedy was killed, and she realized that Lyndon Johnson would be president, I remember thinking that one thing was sure. We had heard the last frank response to a question from the press. And she felt she knew where Johnson really stood. She was sure he was a New Dealer like her. He cared about people, was never callous, never indifferent to suffering. There was a warmth about the man. That was why, she says, that despite some of his votes, the liberals whom he always scoffed at nevertheless forgave him when they wouldn't forgive someone else. While his attempt to portray himself as an insider offended some of his House colleagues, it didn't offend her. He knew what was going to happen. The friendship of Sam Rayburn had much to do with it, but there was also Lyndon's own presence, which exuded the unmistakable air of the Keeper of the Keys. They shared the same feelings for Roosevelt, she was to say, and on the day of his funeral, in April 1945, we were both very depressed. Lyndon invited her to come to his fifth-floor hideaway, and we sat very quietly during the time of the funeral, reminiscing about our president. In this way we became friends, mutual admiration of Franklin Roosevelt. Soon Johnson was coming to the House floor more often than formerly, to sit beside her when she was there, although he didn't stay long. On the floor, he looked the picture of boredom, slumped in his chair with his eyes half closed, she recalls. Then suddenly he'd jump up to his feet nervous, restless, as if he couldn't bear it another minute. And he would leave, loping off the floor with that great stride of his as though he was on some Texas plain. On one occasion on the floor, however, he came to her rescue, or to be more precise, brought Rayburn to her rescue. John Rankin of Mississippi was speaking when he suddenly pointed to a group of liberal representatives who were sitting together and referred to them as "these communists." The other liberals sat silent, afraid to challenge the Mississippi demagogue, all except Helen Douglas. Standing to make a point of order, she said, "I demand to know if the gentleman from Mississippi is addressing me." Rankin looked at me, oh, what a look, and went right on talking, she was to recall. Most congressmen had learned not to confront him, and Helen Douglas had herself once been warned by Majority Leader John McCormick, "Remember, Rankin is a killer." But she didn't sit down. Instead, in her ringing, melodic voice, she said again, "I demand to know if the gentleman from Mississippi is addressing me," and went on standing, a tall blonde figure on the House floor. Since the Speaker had to be in the chair for a point of order, Rayburn entered the chamber and took the podium, saying, "The gentleman from Mississippi will have to answer the Congresswoman." But Rankin, acting as if he had not heard Rayburn, went on talking. As Ms. Douglas recalls, he was such a fearsome man, he appeared to believe himself untouchable. Rayburn, not quite sure what the fuss was about, was letting him do so when Johnson hurriedly approached the podium, Ms. Douglas says. He had been in the House coffee shop when someone ran in and told him, "Helen is taking on Rankin." I was told later that he had bounded up the stairs to the chamber three at a time. As always, he knew the right words to persuade someone to do something. "Who runs this House, you or Rankin?" he whispered up to the Speaker. Sam scowled and banged his gavel again, Helen Douglas recalls. This time his voice was fierce with warning as he again ordered Rankin to answer me.
Rankin measured Rayburn, she was to recall. The speaker did not say another word, but simply stared at Rankin, his face set in the stern mask that men feared. With obvious pain, as Helen Douglas recalls, Rankin said, "I am not addressing the gentlewoman from California." More and more frequently, Lyndon and Helen began arriving on Capitol Hill in the mornings in the same car, sometimes hers, more often his. They would park on New Jersey Avenue, about a block and a half from the House Office Building, and walk to it together, holding hands, a conspicuous couple, both tall, both with dramatic features, walking with long strides as they came up Capitol Hill. Often, at the end of the day, they would drive, together or in separate cars, to Helen's home on 31st Street, where they would have dinner together. They went to parties together. During the first 6 months Helen was in Washington, Melvin was in India, and when he returned, his relationship with Helen proved difficult. Over the next several years, her biographer Ingrid Winther Scobie was to write, their relationship continued to deteriorate. He returned to California. In May 1946, their two children went to California for the summer, and in September were enrolled in a boarding school near Los Angeles. Whatever the considerations that had deterred Lyndon Johnson from advertising his relationship with Alice Glass, they evidently didn't apply to Helen Douglas. He made sure that people believed he was having a physical relationship with her. Not only would they be holding hands when they arrived together in the morning, they sometimes strolled through the Capitol together, with tourists coming up to the former actress to tell her they had enjoyed one of her performances, and they held hands during these strolls. They were a handsome couple, one of Helen's friends, United Nations bureaucrat Charles Hogan, was to recall. A strikingly handsome couple together. She's so much better looking than poor Lady Bird. In particular, it seems, he wanted Alice Glass to believe it. When he parked on New Jersey Avenue, he usually parked in front of number 317, a small building in which Alice's sister, Mary Louise, who was then working on the staff of a Pennsylvania congressman, had an apartment. Helen Douglas's affair with Lyndon started just after she got to Washington, Mary Louise says. I know because I used to see them going to work in the mornings holding hands. And, Mary Louise says, she knew because Johnson wanted her to know. They would park on the street in front of my house, even if there were spaces available on New Jersey Avenue closer to the House Office Building, she says, and she felt he parked there so that she would see the hand-holding and tell Alice about it. If she happened to be coming out of her building while they were parking, Johnson and Helen would walk to work with her. We'd all go in together. In fact, she says, Lyndon himself told her sister about his new affair. Before the war, Alice and Charles Marsh had attended the annual music festival in Salzburg, Austria, and Helen Gahagan Douglas had sung several concerts there. "Well, I've got another girl who spent the summer at Salzburg," Lyndon told Alice, in a remark that hurt her and angered Mary Louise. Just bragging, kissing and telling, she says. Some of Johnson's staff believed the affair was still going on after Johnson was in the Senate. When Horace Busby arrived in 1948, he was told about it by other staff members, and then he saw the hand-holding for himself. It started not long after she came to the house in 1944 and continued on and off for years, Busby was to say. Johnson and Douglas would come back to Suite 231 in the Senate office building together, enter Johnson's private office through the door from the corridor, and stay inside for quite a long time. Others believed it, too. Lyndon would park his car in front of the Douglas house night after night after night, says Creekmore Fath, an attorney from Austin who was a Department of Interior official living in Washington at the time. It was an open scandal in Washington. More than one friend of the two principals urged Helen to break it off, telling her, "You've got to stop Lyndon from doing this." This intense phase of the relationship would end in August 1949, when Helen Douglas returned to California to run for the Senate the following year, in the infamous campaign in which she was defeated by Richard Nixon after his staff published a pamphlet, printed on pink paper, to prove she was soft on communism, and launched a whispering campaign harping on the fact that her husband was Jewish. Lyndon Johnson helped her with advice. It was at his suggestion that she campaigned by helicopter, as he had done in Texas in 1948.
and with campaign contributions from his Texas financial backers. She never ran for public office again. According to her biographer, Scobie, she decided her family had suffered enough from the demands of her career and tried to repair the damage, but with only limited success. Her attempts to resurrect her stage and singing career met with the same result. She did not again live in Washington. Yet while Johnson was vice president, he telephoned Busby one weekend, a weekend when Lady Bird was in New York, and told him to come to his house. When he arrived, he found Johnson and Helen Douglas lounging by the swimming pool in the backyard. They held hands throughout the conversation, and Busby was struck by the real and deep feelings between them. Entering the Senate office building each morning, through the main entrance if he had dropped off Congresswoman Douglas first, otherwise having parked in that space reserved for him on Delaware Avenue through the Delaware entrance, he was the same Lyndon Johnson. The Delaware entrance was a back door, but the door was bronze, tall and heavy, and the walls inside were marble, highly polished marble adorned with fluted pilasters and ornate bronze sconces. Then there were columns, and beyond them, across a circular vestibule, a bank of three elevators, set within tall arches, whose heavily ornamented bronze doors shone like gold. He would press the buttons on all three elevators, and in a fever of impatience press them again. And if an elevator did not then instantly arrive, he would whirl, his jacket flaring out around him, and run up a long, curving flight of stairs. A hulking, hurrying, forward-leaning figure in a flapping suit and wide, garish hand-painted necktie, taking stairs two at a time in that setting of marble and bronze. As a young congressional assistant almost 20 years before, coming up Capitol Hill in the morning from the modest hotel where he lived in a basement room, he had had to pass the Senate building and the Capitol to reach his office in the House office building, and he had run past them in his haste to get to work. He had a shorter way to go to reach his office now, as he had a shorter way to go to reach his great goal, but he was still running. At the top of the stairs, his loping steps would carry him between a pair of tall columns, into that long, high-ceilinged corridor with its marble floor reflecting the ceiling lights, and its row of tall mahogany doors, to the second one on the right, the door to the reception room of his office. When he pushed open that door, he was, in dealing with his staff, the same Lyndon Johnson. With the exception of Connolly, the staff was composed of the kind of men and women Lyndon Johnson wanted, men and women who had demonstrated an unusual willingness to absorb personal abuse. Woody, Mary Rather, who stood head bowed while obscenities swept over her, Glenn Stegall, whose hands would shake as Lyndon Johnson humiliated him in front of his wife, Walter Jenkins, whom Johnson worked like a nigger slave, two roomfuls of men and women willing to let him use the black snake. And he used it. When he arrived at 2:31 each morning, after screeching into that parking space in front of the SOB as the young policeman hurriedly pushed the reserved stanchions out of his way, the door would, in the words of one man, blow open, and Johnson, Jesus God, he filled up the whole room the minute he came in, and if he was really in a bad mood, he would be so excruciatingly rude I would gasp. First thing every morning, he would make the rounds, stopping at every desk and beating up on them, Horace Busby recalls. Then, with a parting bellow, "Come on, let's function, let's function!" he would vanish through the door to his private office, leaving behind two rooms in which, frequently, at least one woman would have been reduced to tears, and men would be sitting stunned by their boss's fury. And even then he might reappear. If a phone rang a second time, you could be sure that that door would open, and... And there was in all his abuse and inspections and orders an element of crudity, of that barnyard talk that made men a bit embarrassed when it poured out in front of female members of the staff. While Johnson was making his rounds of the desks one morning, John Connolly was talking on the phone to Jake Pickle, who worked for Johnson in Texas, and told Johnson, calling across the room, that one of Pickle's assignments had not yet been completed. "Tell Jake to get his finger out of his ass," Johnson yelled back. On another occasion, Jenkins told him about a lack of cooperation from some agency bureaucrat. "What does he want, me to kiss his ass?" Johnson shouted. "Tell him I'll kiss him on both cheeks. I'll kiss him in the middle, too, if he wants it." His office conversation was permeated by sexual imagery. "Take that tie off," he would tell one of his male staffers. "That knot looks like a limp prick." Standing in the middle of the outer office desks, he retied the tie in the Windsor knot, wider and more shaped than the traditional four-in-hand, which was becoming fashionable in 1949, and then stepped back to admire his handiwork.
"Look at that," he said. "He's got a man's knot now, not a limp one."
And assignments to his staff were sometimes made in the same tone. When, during his presidency, a woman reporter wrote critical articles about him, he would tell White House counsel Harry McPherson, "What that woman needs is you. Take her out. Give her a good dinner and a good fuck." And, McPherson would learn, the president wasn't kidding. Joseph A. Califano, Jr., to whom McPherson related the incident, writes that, "Periodically, the president would ask McPherson if he'd taken care of the reporter. Every time she took even the slightest shot at the president, he'd call Harry and tell him to go to work on her." Lyndon Johnson was never kidding when he gave such instructions. He had been doing it at college, even if his language had been more circumspect, in keeping with that earlier time. Says Wilton Woods, one of the White Stars, the San Marcos social group that Johnson turned into a political organization, "Lyndon's idea was to get a real nice-looking girl and see if you could control her, date her, and see how she comes out." Sometimes, during his presidency, the instructions were more specific, as befitted the sexually more explicit 60s. Califano writes that, "LBJ made a similar suggestion, similar to the one he made to McPherson, when I advised him of the problems James Gaither, an aide on my staff, was having with Edith Green, the irascible Democratic congresswoman from Oregon. Johnson became irritated with our inability to deal with her. In exasperation one evening, he said to me, 'God damn it, you've been trying to drag me into this thing when I've got 100 other problems. Well, I'm going to tell you how to get our bill. There's no point in my calling that woman. Gaither's a good-looking boy. You tell him to call up Edith and ask her to brunch this Sunday. Then he can take her out and give her a couple of Bloody Marys and go back to her apartment with her. Then you know what he does? Tell him to spend the afternoon in bed with her, and she'll support any goddamn bill he wants.'" During Johnson's Senate years, the still relatively discreet 50s, his instructions in this area were generally couched more circumspectly, suggesting that a handsome young staff member date a woman whose support he needed. He simply said, "Let nature take its course." But they were nevertheless clear. But if that was still Lyndon Johnson's manner inside his office, it was no longer his manner outside. As Paul F. Healy wrote in the Saturday Evening Post, "When he barks commands, his underlings jump like marionettes. But away from the office, his tone is casual and conciliatory." Behind the closed doors of 231, he may have been the old Lyndon Johnson, but as soon as he stepped out of his office, he was a new Lyndon Johnson, a senatorial Lyndon Johnson. The other senators weren't coming to him, Warren Woodward recalls. He had to go to them. And as he went, usually leaving 231 by the door to his private office and heading down the dim corridors, his very stride changed into a slower, calmer, more dignified pace. And when he reached the office to which he was heading, his demeanor in January could hardly have been more different from his demeanor the month before. The aggressiveness was replaced by the most elaborate courtesy. Not only did he no longer barge into senators' private offices, he took steps to emphasize that he wouldn't even think of barging in. Even if he had already telephoned for an appointment, he would, entering the senator's outer office, ask the receptionist if the senator was free. And even if he was told that the senator was free, even if he was told that the senator was expecting him and he could go right in, he wouldn't go in until the assistant had sent in a note saying that Senator Johnson was in the outer office and would like to see him. And in the case of the most formal senator of all, he went even further. Recalls Harry Byrd's administrative assistant, John Jake Carlton. "He, Johnson, would come in and sit on my desk, and he would say, 'Hi, Jake,' and chat with me. After a while, he would say, 'Oh, by the way, Jake, is the senator in?' 'Yes, would you like to see him?' Johnson would say, 'I'd like to, if you don't mind,' but he wouldn't walk right in, even if I motioned to him that he could. He would wait until I got up and opened the door, so the senator, Byrd, would know that he was going in only after I'd opened the door." When he was in a senator's private office, furthermore, Johnson no longer launched straight into the business about which he had come. He wouldn't say, "Senator, I've got to talk to you about." He would ask about the senator's health, about his wife's health, would solicit his advice, his opinions, inquire about the manner in which some national issue was playing with voters in his home state, get him talking about things he wanted to talk about. And while the senator talked, Lyndon Johnson listened with an obsequiousness, a deference that you wouldn't believe. The deference was unvarying not merely in private, but in public, on the little stage that was the Democratic cloakroom. The senator, who was a fixture there, seemed as much out of another, earlier age as the room itself. Directly opposite the pair of swinging doors opening into the Senate chamber were two deep leather armchairs. In the afternoons, the distinguished Walter George was given to sitting in one of them, telling stories of old Senate battles. Often now, as the revered George of Georgia held forth, squinting a bit through his thick-lensed glasses, patting his white hair into place, Lyndon Johnson would be sitting in the chair next to him. He would not be sitting on the floor, he was a senator now, not a student, but in the adjacent armchair, yet his posture and demeanor would have been familiar to his San Marcos classmates. His long legs would not be stretched out, but tucked back against the chair, and he would be sitting erect and attentive, his chin resting on one hand, his face tilted back so he could look full into George's face as the older man sat beside him, wearing an expression of the deepest interest, his eyes almost shining in admiration as he listened to one anecdote and then asked George to tell him another. Day after day Walter George held court, with, day after day, the same admiring courtier in attendance. Recalling Lyndon Johnson in his early months in the Senate, Warren Woodward says, "He took his time to maybe ingratiate himself with his fellow senators. Once he got settled down, he saw that was necessary. He saw he needed to take his time." Lyndon Johnson had been running all his life. It was very hard for him to stop running, but he stopped. The difference was particularly appealing to the senators because it was cloaked in the broad senatorial badinage with which they were comfortable. Johnson had picked this up very quickly, too. He was, in fact, proficient in this aspect of senatorial style by the swearing-in ceremony, when, immediately after the new senators were sworn, the Senate voted for its president pro tempore, and Vandenberg, being a Republican and therefore now in the minority, was voted out in favor of Kenneth McKellar. Johnson had, of course, voted with the Democrats, and after the ceremony he went up to Vandenberg. "I want to apologize," he said jokingly, referring to the fact that Vandenberg had sworn him in, "for voting against the man who made me a senator." He gave the old statesman a warm smile. Vandenberg, usually so reserved with junior senators, instantly responded, "Well, you shouldn't bite the hand that feeds you," and then he gave Johnson a warm smile back. When, on February 2nd, the 12 new Democratic senators met in the office of Secretary of the Senate, Leslie L. Biffle, to draw lots for their permanent desk assignments, the last of their seniors having finally made his selection, Johnson began bemoaning the fact that he never had any luck at drawings. Clinton Anderson said he'd bet him a nickel over who would get the better seat. "Well, I don't know, Clint. I just don't know," he responded. Finally, he agreed to bet a nickel. Anderson drew desk number 95, a rear seat, and Johnson and Bob Kerr fell into a joking debate over who would draw last, since Kerr felt the last draw was best. "You were in Congress before me," Kerr said in a jokingly bullying manner. "Go ahead and draw." "But you were governor of a state," Johnson replied. "That's higher than a congressman. You draw first." Finally, they decided they would both draw at the same time. They stuck their hands into Biffle's fedora together, and despite their bad luck, the desks they selected were two of the worst in the chamber, Kerr's number 19 being the very last one on the far end of the lowest arc on the Democratic side, Johnson's number 18, the desk next to it. When they saw that they had drawn adjoining desks, they grinned at each other, Kerr with a friendliness in his eyes quite unusual for him. Poor though desk 18's location may have been, its provenance could hardly have been better. When Johnson opened its drawer, among the names of its former occupants carved inside was Harry S. Truman. Encountering a senator in an SOB corridor, Johnson wouldn't approach him in a businesslike way, but in a comradely, good-humored fashion. "Say, I saw one of your constituents the other day," he might say. "I bragged on you, I surely did. I tell you, by the time I got through, he didn't even recognize you." Or, Warren Woodward says, he'd tell a story and get the other senator laughing. It's human nature to like that. He ingratiated himself in a way by being fun to be with. He was a great mimic, a great storyteller, and he always had a story ready. but it was always a light-hearted approach. He wouldn't approach them in a serious way. He stopped saying, "Senator, I need to talk to you about." And at the first Democratic caucus, there was no grabbing of lapels, no leaning into the faces of his colleagues, not a trace of the former pomposity or aggressiveness. What there was the friendliness and politeness of the junior to the senior. And when he introduced himself, he did so with a deprecatory nickname that referred to his narrow last-gasp victory in the recent election. Coupled with a grin, it was very charming. "Howdy," he said to old senators and new, southern senators and northern. "Howdy, I'm Landslide Lyndon." The transformation was very thorough. At the caucus, he was standing to one side chatting with Kerr and Anderson. He had struck up a friendship very quickly with these two fellow newcomers, the former governor of Oklahoma and the former secretary of agriculture. So much so that the three tall Southwesterners were already a small in-group within the class of 48. When an Associated Press photographer asked them to pose, Kerr held up a forefinger as if making a point, as if he were the leader of the threesome. Anderson allowed him to do so, smiling at Kerr for the cameras. And so did Lyndon Johnson. One aspect of his behavior that had annoyed his colleagues in the House of Representatives was his constant subtle, and sometimes not so subtle, maneuvering to get into the center of photographs and to make gestures, such as holding up a commanding finger, that made him the photograph's focal point. But now he simply smiled at Kerr in the friendliest way, as Kerr held up a finger in his face. Nothing, not even an insult, could shatter the new facade. The most insulting of senators was Robert Taft, who could cut and hurt. At a party at the home of Philip and Catherine Graham, another guest watched as Taft was rude and insulting to Johnson, and the guest noted that Johnson passed the matter off in such a gentlemanly manner. The greatest potential for conflict was with the other senator from his own state, and Johnson had, on that trip to Marlin, gotten off on the wrong foot with crusty, irritable Marse Tom Connolly. But he did everything possible to change the footing. Hardly had John Connolly and Walter Jenkins settled into their desks in 231, when tension arose between them and Senator Connolly's assistants over who was going to issue the press releases, and thus obtain the lion's share of the credit, for public works projects and other federal benefits for Texas. The issue, a long festering source of conflict between Connolly and Pappy O'Daniel, seemed likely to become one with 231's new occupant, particularly since, as Connolly and Jenkins well knew, Representative Johnson had fought unceasingly to get the credit even for projects in other congressmen's districts, even for projects with which he had absolutely no connection. But, they found out, Senator Johnson had a different view. He gave Busby instructions, which Buzz relayed to Connolly and Jenkins in a memo, and the operative order was to avoid a clash of any variety with the senator, Connolly. For one thing, Johnson let his aides know, senators were notified before representatives, and there were enough federal projects so that he would get his share of the credit. And, Johnson made clear, a share was enough. Lyndon Johnson had, throughout his life, grabbed for more than his share. He wasn't grabbing now. In the afternoons now, Lyndon Johnson would sometimes leave 231 without telling his staff where he was going, and would be gone for hours. For a while, no one in the office knew where he was spending those hours, until one day a Senate page telephoned with a message for Horace Busby. Senator Johnson wanted him to come over to the Capitol and join him on the Senate floor. After that, Busby would be summoned frequently, either by telephone or by a page who would come to 231 in person and escort him to a side door of the Senate chamber. Seeing his curly-haired young aide, Johnson would motion him over to his desk, and the page would bring a folding chair and place it next to Johnson's. Sometimes the reason for the summons was apparent. A speech was being given that Johnson wanted Busby to hear. Busby understood that Johnson wanted his speeches to sound senatorial, so he wanted his speechwriter to hear what senators sounded like. He paid particular attention to Senator George, Busby says, but he also wanted Busby to hear senators who were not regarded as particularly outstanding orators, but who sounded senatorial. He always wanted me to hear Leverett Saltonstall, and he was kind of taken with Henry Cabot Lodge. Often, however, Busby would be called to the floor when no major speech was being given, and the Senate was merely transacting routine, monotonous business. He would sit down next to Johnson as a desultory discussion or slightly more interesting debate ensued, or as a quorum call droned on. Sometimes Johnson would whisper to him behind a cupped hand. Somebody would be making a motion, and he'd be very attentive to that. He hadn't had to do that in the House. He wasn't part of the action over there, and the Speaker or whoever was in the chair had all the authority over there. There would be some maneuver, and he'd talk to me behind his hand. You think he's going to succeed at that? But often Johnson wouldn't say anything at all, for quite a long time. Usually there weren't many senators around, Busby recalls. Two or three senators interested in a particular bill would come onto the floor, and the bill disposed of would leave to be replaced by two or three others. Individual senators would wander in and out. Stars and spear carriers changed. The majority and minority leaders wandered in and out. The Senate reporters, who recorded every word spoken on the floor, changed regularly, every 30 minutes. Clerks would come and go on the lower level of the dais. But Lyndon Johnson would remain, sitting at his desk, intent and still, a long, motionless figure slouched down deep in his chair, his head resting on a big hand, among the long, empty arcs of desks. He was just sitting there watching the Senate, Busby recalls. Busby soon came to understand that he really had been summoned because Johnson was going to be there for many hours and wanted company. It was like part of him was a spectator, and he liked to have someone sitting there with him, Busby says. But for a long while he couldn't understand why Johnson was there for so many hours. It was obvious that the reason was very important to him, but I didn't know what it was, he says. I didn't know what he was doing there, sitting hour after hour in the almost deserted chamber floor as the afternoon oozed away in quorum calls and the dull staccato chant of the calendar call. And then Busby did understand. He was learning, studying. In part, he was studying senatorial procedure, those arcane Senate rules, although, Busby noticed, after Johnson observed that on thorny parliamentary points the party leaders or the senator in the chair usually consulted the Senate parliamentarian, Charles L. Watkins, instead of relying on their own knowledge, he became less interested in procedure. He, too, would be able to refer questions to Watkins. In part, he was studying senatorial demeanor, the manners of senators of the United States. Woodward says, he, Johnson, had a general feeling that when you moved to the Senate you had to be more statesmanlike, more senatorial. Saltonstall and Lodge and Alabama's Lister Hill were being studied not merely because they spoke in a senatorial manner, but because they acted senatorial, formal, dignified, courtly in the best sense of those words. Saltonstall and Lodge, Busby says, were gentlemen, real New England gentlemen, the kind of person you didn't find in Texas. Hill was a gentleman, too, if of the Southern mode. What Johnson was trying to learn from them was not merely speech-making, but a mode of senatorial discourse, the manner in which they introduced motions and bills, and spoke in debate. And in part, Johnson was studying men, not their demeanor, but what lay underneath. The Senate chamber was, after all, a good place to observe his new colleagues. Most of the time, senators were in their offices or in the hearing rooms of their committees. You might get to know the senators who served on the same committees as you, yet see other senators seldom, unless you saw them on the floor. In the chamber, Johnson could study all the senators, could read them. From his desk at the far end of the lowest arc, Lyndon Johnson watched the figures moving among the desks, coming up and down the center aisle, chatting together in the well. He watched which senators went over to other senators to chat with them, and which senators sat at their desks and let other senators come to them.
End of Disc 7.